Hey God, we're here and we just want to worship you today and we want to say thank you for the Sabbath. Thank you for this time we could worship you. We can come together as a community, as a little family of people who believe in you and who want to worship you. So Father, I pray that as we do that today, that your Spirit fills us up, that we can really commune with you, that we can feel you touch our hearts today through your word. And Lord, I just pray that you sustain us in the time to come. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, open your Bibles with me to Mark 10, please. We'd had a Sabbath school this morning about harvesting and working in the field, and I guess, I felt impressed to share my testimony with you today. Oh, she's got a flower. That's fantastic. I'd be pretty excited too. Mark 10, we're going to. Mark chapter 10. Now, I want to give you my testimony, but because I don't, despite what you may think, like talking about myself too much, I'm also going to talk about Bartimaeus. And his story begins in verse 46. And I want to set the scene for you, because Bartimaeus here lives in Jericho in the Middle East. And look, the scene here in Jericho, and I've seen Jericho, and it's set in this desert. I don't know if you've ever been like to the middle of Australia, or if you've ever been somewhere very hot, like 33 today doesn't really count. But when it's really hot, as it is in the Middle East, there's this haze in the air, dust gets kicked up, and so there's this fine film of dust over everything. And you know what? There's these date palms everywhere. And the date palms are ripening in the air. And you can smell this sweet scent in the air of date palms. Maybe if you're lucky, you get a gentle breeze. But generally, in the middle of the day or any time of day, the sun is brutal. And it beats down on you from an angry sky. And that's what it's like in the Middle East. And this day in the Middle East, in that heat, in this day, at Jericho, there's a man by the side of the road begging. Now, he's not a proud man, but he's wise, because on this day, there are a lot of people traveling, and they're traveling through Jericho, and they're traveling to Jerusalem for a specific reason. It's the perfect time to beg. Passover's coming. What a perfect time for someone to sit out by the side of the road and beg. And it's a good thing that he's not a proud man, because I don't know if you've ever had to beg for anything, but begging is pretty much as low as you can go here. It's just about the bottom of the ladder. I remember once being stuck in Central Station in Sydney with zero money and zero food and a 24-hour wait before my next train. And I had nothing. And I was reduced to going to shop vendors in the station asking for handouts. And I was so ashamed of myself. I mean, I was asking for the food they were going to throw away at the end of the day. But I hated myself for doing it. I felt like I shouldn't have to, like I should be able to provide for myself. And you know what? When someone was kind to me, while I was so happy that they were kind to me and I was excited because I could have some food, I was also a little bit angry. And I guess I felt angry at them, but really I was angry at myself for letting myself get into that situation. Begging is not good. If you're a beggar in these times especially, then you're seen pretty much low. People understood why you did it. There wasn't any public pension you could draw on. There wasn't any government assistance that you could get. You were supposed to be helped by the people who lived around you. If you were begging, then maybe you'd been cursed by God. And you were definitely avoided by man. Because, hey, if you ever live somewhere where there's someone who's always begging for money all the time, and you walk past that person, in Melbourne I encounter this all the time. You walk past the same street and there's always the same person there asking for money. And after a while you start wanting to cross the road just to avoid them, because they're always there asking and asking. And after a while, living in a big city, in Sydney especially, you end up getting this kind of blindness to them. You just can't see them, you can't hear them, and you walk past them. You don't even notice them. It's not fun. And I guess I also used to be a different kind of beggar. although I didn't know it at the time. And I wasn't begging for money or for food, but I was just as poor and penniless as Bartimaeus would have been here, just as without reason and hope and joy. Let's have a look at verse 46 here. Then they came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, that is, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. And you know, I shouldn't have been a beggar. I shouldn't have been begging in life. And you'll get what I mean in a minute. I grew up in a good Christian family. You know, I was raised in a different church. I was raised in the Roman Catholic Church. And my mum and dad made me go to Mass every Sunday. I was an altar boy. You should have seen me. Boy, was I cute. In that, I know, hard to guess looking at me now, but back then when I had like the little white robe on and this little, my mum would cut my hair with a ruler, not like with a ruler, but she'd put this ruler against my forehead. Who's done the ruler cut, right? I've tried that on my daughter. It's not as easy as it looks because the hair slides out, but like, you should have seen it. My mum had it perfect and my hair was like, you could cut yourself if you touched it. It was in this little bowl, in this angelic face, in this white robe holding a candle. Oh, you could just about hear the angels, right, just looking at me. My mother was so proud, and she held out high hopes that I was going to be a priest, because as everyone knows, the mothers of priests get into heaven for free, right? That's what she told me anyway, so I believed her. And I thought, well, that wouldn't be bad. Automatic admittance, just for the mothers apparently, not the fathers. I don't know why that is so, but that's how it is. But you know, that was a lot of fun, and I got to stand up the front with this candle and look kind of superior at everyone and look holy and look off in the middle distance while they all came up and did things. It was very exciting, but after a while, you know, I kind of got bored with it. I kind of was just doing it for me. And the interest that I had in religious matters, I guess, kind of started fading away. And I started looking around for something to entertain me and to keep me interested. I went away from home to a boarding school. And that was when I was in year 11 and 12. I went to boarding school. And they would force us to go to church. And without my family or the people that I knew from church, the guy up the front, the sermons didn't seem really relevant. It was like a Benedictine priest. And they liked to sing half of their stuff. You're really glad, you've got to be glad that I don't sing half of the stuff that I say up here, right? If you'd heard me sing, you would be. So it didn't seem really relevant to me, and I figured, hey, I'm just going to go find out my own way in the world. I'm not going to stick around for this, because there's no one making me go to church. So I thought, oh, I just won't. No one's going to stop me. And once I left school, I stopped attending altogether. Now, while I was at school, I had this experience with God, and I kind of knew that he was there, but way, way off there. God was in heaven, and I was on earth, and he didn't really seem to care what I did. So I decided to leave him to him and take me off and do my own thing. So I left school, and I went to university in Canberra, to the Australian National University. I got admitted to a science degree, and I immediately stopped going to church, and I devised this cunning plan how to deal with God and religion and death and all that kind of stuff. This was my plan. I'm going to do what I want for my whole life and just run and just do whatever I want. God didn't seem to care. And so when I got to my deathbed, I'd get the priest in, do a huge confession, and slip in the back door to heaven. I thought it was a perfect plan. That way I'll get to do whatever I like and still get into heaven, right? It's a win-win for me, as far as I could see. I couldn't see any problems with my plan. And so, with a clear conscience, I set off to explore all that Canberra and a responsibility-free lifestyle could offer, which I thought was going to be quite a lot. At least I was away from those churches that seemed just to make me feel guilty and kind of bored. Finally, I could live the life that I wanted to, and I was going to find happiness. That's what I was determined to do, find the best happiness that I could for my life. So I drifted away from God and thought about him less and less, because I thought surely without all these rules and stuff that I seemed to have to do, I was going to be happier. But the strange thing is that as I lived my life in Canberra, as I explored all the options open to an adult, at least as far as my meagre Aus study allowance would let me, I noticed something. Instead of getting happier, instead of being more fulfilled in my life, I started to, in fact, be the opposite. The alcohol that I thought made me so witty and charming started draining my funds, and I would miss my classes because I slept through them because I was hungover. And before I knew it, I'd started failing courses, and before I knew it, 7 years had passed while me going to university, I still hadn't gotten a degree after 7 years. Now, I'm still paying off those hex fees today, by the way. Yeah. My poor parents were at wit's end because they didn't know their son anymore. They felt that I was just running away from them. I started work and left university just because I needed to pay the bills. And despite all the partying that I was doing, I still wasn't any happier. I still seemed to be more miserable. I was sick a lot of the time. And the alcohol didn't seem to make up for that misery. Sure, I might be a little happier for a little brief amount of time, but it didn't last. And so I started turning to other substances, looking for that kind of happiness and that sense of completion in me. I was trying desperately to have this kind of ideal, glittering, happy life that I thought I deserved, that I thought I was entitled to. But even as I seemed to try and reach for that prize, the very things that people told me that would give that to me were ruining me and making me more miserable. I didn't understand. I didn't get it. And so there I was, a beggar by the roadside of life, begging for scraps of joy, seeking just a little bit of happiness here and there. Although I didn't know at the time that I was a beggar. I thought I had it all. My friends told me that I had it all. If you'd asked me at the time, I would have even said, no, I'm happy. But really, I didn't even know what happiness was. I just thought I was happy because people told me that I was happy. Bartimaeus at least knows that he's a beggar, and you've got to give him credit for that. His solution to having no money is to ask strangers for his livelihood. Now, he's blind. It says here in verse 46 that he's a blind man. He can't work. You can't work when you're blind. So he's not even able to glean from the fields. God made provision for people who have no money. They could glean from the sides, the edges, the corners of the fields when farmers didn't finish their crops. They could take the food from there and at least live. But he's blind. How could he do that? All he's got left is begging. He's the son of Timaeus. It doesn't say that he has any family of his own, just that his father was called Timaeus. And his father either can't support him or isn't in the picture anymore for some reason. So Bartimaeus is stuck in Jericho. How can you can't get a lift anywhere. There's no public bus. How do you even get to the next town if you're blind without help? Bartimaeus is left to fend for himself. It can't have been a very good life. But this day is different. This day we're looking at here is different because down the road walking towards Jericho is Jesus and his disciples and a bunch of other people. It says there's a large crowd. Everyone's heading towards Jerusalem for the Passover, right? The big festival. This is the one we're going to go to, Passover. Now, just to put this day in perspective of where Jesus is, the very next day, from this day, Jesus is going to ride into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey and be hailed with hosannas and palm branches. That's the next day after this. In 3 days' time, he's going to be sitting at Simon's house and he's going to be anointed with expensive oil. That's in 3 days' time from this day. In 5 days' time, he's going to be sitting in an upper room with his disciples sharing a final meal. And in 6 days' time, Jesus will be hanging on a cross outside the city gates at Jerusalem. Less than a week from this day, Jesus would be dead. But right now, he's with his disciples, and he's with this large crowd moving towards Jerusalem. Large crowd makes a lot of noise, and Bartimaeus may be blind, but he's not deaf. Let's have a look at verse 47. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Can you imagine Bartimaeus hearing this crowd passing him by? The people in the crowd are talking to Jesus and his disciples. Jesus is really well known. His ministry has been going for 3.5 years, and now they're moving towards Jerusalem. Maybe there's this buzz of excitement. Maybe he hears the name. Obviously, Bartimaeus has heard about Jesus by now. Jesus has been out there healing just about everyone in Israel except for him. He would go to a town and everyone would be healed by the time that he left. As a blind man, can you imagine hearing stories about this person who goes around and heals blind people? And then all of a sudden, one day you're sitting there and you hear that name mentioned in front of you. People calling out to him to speak to him. He hears this. Lepers have been made clean. The dead have walked. The blind can see again. Can you imagine the hope that must have blossomed in Bartimaeus' heart at that time? What does he do? Does he sit still and think, oh, I better not say anything. What if it's not him? I better be quiet. No. He calls out in his loudest voice, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And that's in his desperation and in his pain. He yells out into the darkness. Does he know for sure that it's Jesus passing him by? He knows it's a Jesus. It wasn't an uncommon name. You know, you can talk about all your Bible heroes and people like David and people like Moses and people like Abraham, or they like Peter as their Bible heroes. But for me, this act of Bartimaeus makes him a hero for me. Because what does he do? When he calls out, he doesn't just say, hey, Jesus, you there? He doesn't say, is that Jesus somewhere? No. When he calls out, he declares his faith. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. He says, Jesus, you're the Son of David. Now, he's acknowledging that bloodline, the bloodline that's mentioned in prophecy in Isaiah 9, where it says it will be a Son of David who is the Messiah. So by saying Son of David, Bartimaeus is saying, you are the Messiah, Jesus. Jesus, Messiah. Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. By saying that, he's saying, you have the ability to forgive my sins. You can have mercy on me. No one else can forgive sins but God. By saying, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. He is saying, Jesus, Messiah, you are God, in that one sentence. And he's calling it out, which is tantamount to blasphemy, to say this, to say that Jesus can forgive sins. He's calling it out in front of a crowd of strangers. He's declaring his faith out loud. And he is just a beggar on the side of the road. He's asking for mercy. By calling out, what do you think happened? Do you think every eye in that crowd just went whoop to this guy sitting in his beggar's robes by the side of the road with his robe out in front of him to collect alms? He's calling attention to himself, maybe for nothing, maybe Jesus isn't even in earshot, but he calls out just the same. Now, I don't know if I would have had the same courage that Bartimaeus does. I don't know. Do you think you would? Maybe you have. Maybe you've said something like this. Maybe we would hold back. Yeah, I held back a lot. And I held back from calling out to God a lot in my own life. And you know what? I'd reached rock bottom. And one day I woke up in a strange house in Sydney with strange people around me and no memory of how I got there. And finally, I guess I kind of realized that in seeking this fulfillment and joy, I was exposing myself to danger. And I was lapsing in judgment, that I was actually close to causing myself harm, if not from the alcohol, physically, by being unconscious in front of a group of strangers. And I thought back to when I'd actually been, I guess, a little bit happy, and I tried to remember the last time that I'd felt kind of fulfilled and content. And I kind of thought, and I hated to admit it, but it was when I knew God. It was when I felt closer to God. So you know what I did? I went to the local Bible store and I bought a Bible. And I've still got it. It's a contemporary English version. And I took it home. And you know what I did with this Bible? I placed it next to my bed and I would like go to sleep with my hand on it. And I would kind of like put it under my pillow and sleep on it like that. just trying to get some kind of comfort from this Bible without actually opening it. I was like some guy in the middle of the desert dying of thirst, holding on to this bottle of water, hoping that things would get better without actually opening it, right? Wondering why I wasn't feeling any better. Yeah, I didn't know what to do. I had no one to guide me. I was by myself. Growing up in the Roman Catholic Church, I'd never opened the Bible. The priest had the Bible, and he just read out to me what it was. I had no idea what it was, or that I could even really do anything with it or even read it. Now, it was about that time I met a girl who seemed to be going through similar things as me. She didn't go to church anymore. She was kind of disillusioned by it all. But she had something that I didn't have. She had still this connection with God. And I could see it. It was just plain as day that she had something that I didn't have. She knew God. And even though she wasn't going to church at the time, there was this thing there, this peace in her that I didn't have. And I thought, that's what I want. That's what I want. And, you know, God and I still had this uneasy kind of truce. The deathbed confession plan was still in place. And then one day this girl said to me something that gave me pause. She told me that Saturday was the seventh day of the week. And I was in my, I guess, early 20s at this time. And I said to her, don't be ridiculous. That's crazy. It's obviously Sunday. Look, when does everyone go to church? It's Sunday. So she very calmly and politely told me to check my dictionary, which I did, and sure enough, it said Saturday was the seventh day of the week. I hadn't known my whole life. And look, the most important book in our house growing up was the dictionary. If I didn't know a word, Mum would be like, go check the dictionary. Go check the dictionary. I learned to read and loved to read. So when I read here in black and white in this dictionary that Saturday was the seventh day of the week, I was floored. I was in my mid-20s and no one had ever told me. I had no idea. It seemed natural to me that you know, the week started on Monday. That's when school started. But there I was. And, you know, you guys maybe knew this your whole life, or maybe you didn't. But for me, it was a big deal. I had no idea. And look, Why am I making a big song and dance about this? Because I thought I knew it about God. I thought I knew stuff about religion and God. I was an altar boy. But if I'd gotten this wrong, if I didn't even know what day of the week it was, what if my plan was wrong? What if my deathbed confession thing wasn't going to work? What if it doesn't work? So I found myself rethinking things. And at the same time, I got kind of angry. I'd been lied to. No one had ever told me this. God had been misrepresented to me by those people that I trusted. So I decided to find out for myself. And it was about this time that this girl and I received a flyer in our letterbox. And it was for a program at a nearby church. And it had three angels on the front of it. And she said, I know who this is from. This is from my church. And I said, all right, let's go. So we went along to it. That was in 1999, Net 99, with Doug Batchelor and John Lomacane. I warned her. I said, look, I'm happy to go with you to this church and to listen to this stuff, this Bible study, whatever you do, but I'm never going to change. I was born Catholic. I've grown up Catholic. It's a part of me. It's a part of my identity. You're not going to change my mind. She said, okay, no, I'm not even going to try. I said, that's great. So I went along to this church, and she never argued with me, but she would just occasionally ask if I wanted to go to church. Now, we went to these whole programs, and it was quite amazing, right? And I learned a lot from it, and I learned what the Bible seemed to say. But did it change my heart? No. I held back. And you know what? Her asking me to go to church was a big deal. Because for me, when you grow up in the Catholic Church, the Mass is about, I don't know, 35, 40 minutes long. And so she would say, come to church. I'm like, well, when does it start? She says, oh, 9:30. When does it finish? Oh, 12. What? What are you going to do for 2.5, 3 hours at church? How could anyone possibly, because for me, church was so boring when I was a kid. I used to like count the number of nails in the wall. It was that bad. It really was. And so I thought, no, why would you do that for that long? But eventually she got me to come along. And I remember we'd moved to Queensland at this time. And we went along to this church. And we arrived at the door. And there's this, I think he's a Maori guy, right? And he walks over to me and gives me this big hug. I'm like this, right? And he says, "Welcome, brother." And I thought, okay, this is a bit strange. I don't know you. Why are you calling me that? And we walked in and we sat down and it all seemed okay though. The people in front of us turned around and said, "Hey, do you want to come to a hangi tonight?" I'm like, "Okay, what's a hangi?" You know, my wife's a Kiwi, so this girl next to me, she said, "Oh, it's, you know, you'll like it." I'm like, "Okay, we'll go." It was fantastic, right? The church was very welcoming and friendly. Then the head elder stood up and preached about the evils of the Roman Catholic Church. And this girl sitting next, my girl's going, "Oh no. Oh no." Like, you wouldn't believe it, right? It was just the worst thing. She thought I was never going to go back to church again. And I think about Bartimaeus, you know, we go through times of testing in our journey of faith. As in our walk towards God, we have our faith tested. And Bartimaeus did, because have a look with me what happens. After he's shouted out this cry to Jesus, have a look at verse 48. What's the reaction from the crowd to this man seeking Jesus, who they're all accompanying? What do they say? Verse 48, many rebuked him and told him to be quiet. But he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." The first reaction that he gets from the crowd is one of discouragement. They tell him to be quiet, to sit down. Don't disturb the master. He's much more important than you. And you know what? I think we can be guilty of that in the church sometimes. In our feeble attempts to be closer to God, we drive people away. In our striving to be what God wants us to be, we put such a burden on people that it drives them away. And let me make this very clear. The people who are rebuking Bartimaeus, they're not the heathens, they're not the non-believers. These are the church folk. These are the religious people going to Passover, walking with Jesus. They're the ones rebuking someone who is seeking God. Bartimaeus was a beggar beneath their notice and definitely below that of their master. Does it discourage Bartimaeus though? Nope, what a guy. He yells out and it says, all the more. He doesn't just yell out again, he redoubles his efforts. All the more, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Bartimaeus passes his test of faith. He goes through discouragement and yet cries out all the more for Jesus. Then the miracle happens. Have a look at verse 49. Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." This is Jesus Christ, the anointed one, the Son of God, the Lamb of God, divinity made flesh, only days away from a universe-changing moment. Jesus Christ stops in the village of Jericho because a beggar has called his name. You ever tried stopping in the middle of a crowd on the sidewalk? People start bumping into you, going around you, pushing you around a bit. Jesus stops because Bartimaeus calls out. And he said, "Call him." So they call to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Finally, this is the message the church is supposed to give. Cheer up, on your feet, Jesus is calling you. That's the message we're supposed to give. The crowd have changed their tune. All of a sudden they're being helpful. They're passing on the right message to the beggar. Bartimaeus has passed his test of faith. I almost didn't. Because I persisted with this church, even though they didn't like the Catholics, because the people in it, the ones that had invited us out to dinner, they were so loving. They were the ones that won me over, the people who cared for us. Something amazing happened. I started going more and more, and I noticed slowly I began to warm up on the inside. I started to experience some moments of real happiness and companionship and joy and peace. Sometimes I even went for the whole service, and I would sit in Sabbath school, and you know what? I loved it. I wouldn't tell Vanessa. By the end of the 3 hours, I would just feel on fire and so happy and jubilant and alive. But I couldn't tell her that I was getting that much out of it. Oh, yeah, it was all right, I'd say. Yeah, it was fine. But whenever we came home from church, I felt alive in a way that I hadn't for a long time. But I had my tests because there are a few things holding me back. I had habits left over from my old life, and they were really hard to kick. I had my old expectations of God, that He was a distant God as well, and I felt like I had to be perfect before God would accept me, and I knew that I was a long way from perfect. I was keeping Him at arm's length. And then one night, as I was driving to a prayer meeting, something life-changing happened, I guess, for me. It came to a head. I still remember it very clearly as I was driving up a road to a T-intersection. I started turning left to put on the indicator in the car, and I was driving my wife's car at the time. She wasn't my wife yet, though. And anyway, I looked out to the right, as you do, right, to see if there's any cars about to come through in front of you. And instead, what I saw was a car heading directly for me. And, you know, it just barreled at me. There was no braking. It just sped at me the whole way. And I was just sitting there. There was nothing I could do. It was just happening in a split second. But at the same time, that split second seemed to stretch out. And I could see the people in the car coming towards me as they were like this, right? And the next thing I know, there's this big noise, and their car hit my car in the driver's door, drove my car across the road into the gutter, and then it dug underneath and forced my car up onto two wheels. They got out of the car and ran away because the car was stolen. And I crawled across the center console and across the glass and got out the other side and shook myself off and looked up and down, and I didn't have a scratch on me. Not a scratch. The tow truck driver came and looked at me and looked at the car and said, "Man, that's a write-off. Your car's going to be written off." Sure enough, it was. But I didn't have a scratch on me. And it kind of occurred to me, hey, this event, you know, I should have at least got a scratch. But I didn't. And I realized that maybe God was real and really with me. Not just in an intellectual, well, I understand what the Bible says way, but perhaps He really cared for me. Perhaps He really wanted to help me. A life-changing event. I survive a car accident that I should have at least been hurt in. And for Bartimaeus, Jesus stood still. What happens next? Jesus has said, "Call him." You know, that's a kind of a funny thing, right? Because, let's face it, he's saying, "Come here," to a blind guy. When you think about it, that's kind of mean, isn't it? "Over here, come on." But let's look what he says. Jesus says, "Call him," to the crowd. Jesus has asked the crowd to bring Bartimaeus to him. Jesus has asked the religious folk, the church, to bring people who need him. He asks the crowd to call him. Bartimaeus is ready just as he is, though. He is not waiting to be perfect. He knows his need. Look what he does. He throws his cloak aside. Verse 50. Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. Now, this is kind of a big deal. You may not realize it, but it is. Because that cloak is a beggar's most prized possession. When you go out begging and it's raining, you put your cloak over you. When you want to put something in front of you to collect the money, you put your cloak in front of you to catch the money. This is his main garment. This shows that he's a beggar, that he uses this hard-worn cloak. What's the first thing he does, though? He throws it away. You know why? He's not going to need it. He knows he's not going to need it anymore. He knows that Jesus has heard him. He throws, in faith, his cloak aside and jumps to his feet. Imagine the excitement. He's jumped up. He's like, at last. And he comes to Jesus. And then Bartimaeus has this moment with God, with Jesus. I can just imagine them standing in this crowd, the disciples pushing around it, people on the outside. What's going on in there? The noise, the chatter, all stilled by Jesus stopping. Jesus says, "What do you want me to do for you?" in verse 51. The blind man said, "Rabbi," which should be an obvious question, right? Gee, what does this blind guy want? Rabbi, I want to see. Of course, Jesus knew what he wanted. But you know what? By asking, Bartimaeus is showing that he has faith that Jesus can deliver. You don't ask someone for something that they can't give you, right? You don't ask someone if you know they don't have it. You don't ask someone for something. Jesus is saying, what do you want? Bartimaeus says, I want to see because you can do it. You can make me see. Bartimaeus shows complete faith in Jesus this whole time. What do we ask Jesus for? Can we have this if it's okay, please, Jesus? Or maybe if it fits in your will. Bartimaeus is just open and honest and says, I need this. He asks Jesus for what he needs out of the depths of his need, and he's honest with him. What does Jesus say? 52, go, said Jesus. Your faith has healed you. Immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. Immediately Bartimaeus can see. A moment with God in the midst of this turmoil, of this crowd, can do amazing things in your life. Just one moment with God. Where he says, what do you need? And you're open and honest with him. And I want to say, look at all the people. When you look at all the people in the Bible who've had an encounter with God, or even an angel from God, their lives before and their lives after are always very different. You don't get people who God says, what do you need? And they go, oh, nothing, we're fine, thanks God. Everything's okay. And you don't get God coming down saying, hey, just keep going, you're doing a good job, no news, just keep being who you are. You never see that, right? God comes down and says, Mary, you're going to have a child. Bang! Life completely different. God comes down and says, Moses, go and get my people. Bang! Life completely different. God comes down and says, Abraham, you're going to move to a country that I've found for you. When God comes into your life, when you have that moment with God, you'll know it because everything is immediately changed. And you know what? I wish for me that it hadn't taken a car accident. I hear testimonies from people, and I know people who have been in the church all their life, and I'm so jealous. I'm like, you knew this stuff. I wish I could have had that. I was so jealous of my wife. I wish I didn't have to go through what I went through to find God. How much better if I'd saved all those years. I feel like now that they've been wasted. And you know, I wasted some of them myself because I thought that I couldn't come to Jesus while I wasn't perfect. But in fact, I finally realized that I was never going to be perfect without him. I was sitting on a fence, and so after this car accident, I had a realization. The fence is owned by the devil. It's not God's. He's calling me onto his side. So I finally gave in. I finally stopped holding back in my heart. And the moment that I did that, I noticed something astonishing. I found that that part of me, that little part of me that had been searching for happiness, that empty part of me that had been looking for peace, was quietly filled. I was complete. It didn't take a big bang for it to happen. It just took for me to call out to Jesus and say, yes, yes, yes. After I did that, I found that 3 hours of church sped by. I found a lot of things changed, actually, once I made that final commitment. That girl and I finally got married, and we've been married now for 12 years, and she still is surprising me and sharing me things. Not long after that marriage, I was baptized at Eden's Landing in Brisbane, and that's still one of the happiest days of my life. Because Jesus stopped for Bartimaeus, he also stopped for me. And I know that Jesus, when you call out to him, will stop for you. When you're sitting there on that busy road feeling like a beggar on the highway of life, if you call out to Jesus in faith, he will stop for you too. Now, Bartimaeus and I both started following. Bartimaeus followed Jesus along the road. And, you know, some scholarship suggests that because we know the name of this beggar, because we know the name Bartimaeus, that his name was known amongst the disciples. That was a story they told each other about him, that they knew him. And they knew him because he was a person that they knew in the Christian church later, that he became a Christian leader, and that's why they knew his name. His name isn't mentioned in the story. They must have known him, and he must have told people about what had happened to him. You know what? I really feel like I've got a lot in common with Bartimaeus. We both had to realize that we were at rock bottom before we actually got that we needed God. We have to both go through a test of faith and try and pass. He passed his a lot more easily than I did. We were both brought to a moment of truth with God, a face-to-face moment of truth with God, and were changed by that encounter, and we both followed Jesus along the way. And you know what? Because of Jesus, I'm no longer a beggar. My cup runneth over, in fact, because he's the one who has the feast. He's the one who stood still for me. And I want to invite you today, if you feel the need, to ask Jesus to stand for you. I'd like you to stand now as we sing our final song. Burdens are lifted at Calvary, because that's what Jesus offers, to lift those burdens, to feel that part of you that is searching, to have mercy on us, if we just look to him in faith.